Welcome to The Colorcast, a show about color grading, color science, and post-production. We are the Coloristas. I'm Jason Myers, a colorist in Los Angeles.
And I'm Josh Petock, a colorist in Los Angeles as well.
And I'm Juan Salvo, a colorist in New York City. And today, we all sound equally bad because we're recording live from the NAB show floor, where we're our annual pilgrimage, where we all get together and actually do an in-person Coloristas. And we just wanted to talk to you, I guess, about kind of our impressions, what's going on at NAB, what are we seeing, what are we being impressed by, what's maybe news that we found interesting or exciting. Josh, do you want to talk about anything?
Well, you can't get away from Black Magic. They're always the center of attention at all of these shows.
Yeah.
And this show was no exception.
It wasn't.
They, you know, again, released another camera. They released
two cameras.
It Resolve 11. You know, it was interesting they called the camera an Ursa, right? Which is, I assume, is from
a reference
Cintel.
To Cintel.
Yeah.
So is that from is that based on any R&D that they got from Cintel? You think? I'm assuming it had to be.
I think it's just
you don't think so?
A
just
trademark
the name?
Property. Yeah. I mean, there's also like Ursa Minor, Ursa Major.
Right.
But it's a beastly looking camera. It's like a legit production camera.
The screen is massive. It's like an iPad.
It's huge, and it looks like a serious production camera. Like, you're not going, that's a rinky-dink operation. Like, it looks like a, you know, an F-65 size body. It's pretty intense.
It looks like a camera that would be a perfect prop for a Star Trek episode, you know, placed another 1,000 years beyond where Star Trek is actually set.
or like, kind of like it's like a 60s imagination of what like a 21st century camera would look like.
Right.
It's kind of like, it's a little retro and it's sort of like futureness.
The thing that's neat though that I found, I mean, just, you know, I'm not myself a DP, but if I take a look at that camera, I see Blackmagic is really attempting to address some things that they thought were pain points in prior camera designs. And I think there's a bit of an experiment there with, you know, the very large viewfinder. It's got to be the single largest built-in viewfinder ever on any camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, it's going to be interesting to see.
It's not a viewfinder either.
It's a pure monitor. Yeah,
yeah,
it swings out of sight. I mean,
it's an iPad.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
Is it touchscreen as well?
I don't know. But there's a lot of buttons, so I think it's not.
I think it might be. I think the buttons are there for the for first AC.
Yeah, and so long story.
That's one of their selling points. It's like the idea. It's like, it's actually like in one camera you have kind of three workstations.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're able to have the first the DOP, the first AC, all kind of working together.
Yeah. And they, you know, the buttons are large. They're very big, clear readouts. They look like they'd be very bright even in broad daylight. And they've tried very hard to do some innovative things, like the camera itself. I think it can detect a clap, you know, and things like that. So you can, you know, attempt to, you know, work through some of the things that people find encumbrances now. You know, they're trying to solve it right in the camera.
Did you hear about the HDMI mount?
No.
On it?
What's that?
So you could get, you know, any kind of mount, you know, EF mount, PL mount.
PL. Yeah.
But you can also get what's in a HDMI mount, and you can send another camera into it, and it becomes a camera back.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
Hmm.
Huh, that's really interesting.
But potentially you could use it to record anything that's sending out HDMI. You could do 5D if you wanted to.
So versatile. It's just like an everything box. It's really kind of amazing how much they're putting into those things. And, I mean, it's incredible to see how far we've come. I mean, it would be unimaginable, you know, 3 years ago if you had said you'd have this kind of spec on a camera.
Right.
And it would be,
$6,000.
Or $5,000 if you get the EF version.
Right.
That you would be laughed out of the room. It's just insane. And then not only that, but you have AJA has their own 4K camera that has actually kind of similar specifications.
Right.
It looks like kind of like an Alexa if you kind of squash down an Alexa a little bit. Also has a lot of thought to the ergonomics of what the camera is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's also $9,000 and it does 60 frames per second, does XLR input. I mean, it's kind of a killer device as well.
Yeah, it looks a lot like sort of a combination of an Arri Alexa and an Iconoscope. You know, it's got sort of, it's like a slender Alexa.
Do you think that there's any danger in all these post companies making cameras?
That they have never made cameras before.
They have never made cameras before.
I mean, I tweeted that, like, the camera is the new video card, right? Like, that's the new video I/O. It's like your imaging device. I don't know if it's dangerous. I mean, I do think that, like,
you could tell, like, the first versions of the Blackmagic Cinema Camera, like, these are guys that did not understand cameras. Like, oh, you need multiple batteries on this? Yeah, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
And they fixed that in the pocket camera. Even in the pocket camera, they were like, oh, okay, yeah, you guys want to replace batteries. I get it, yeah.
You're going to have to do it every 20 minutes.
But they're okay with that. I mean, Blackmagic has always done that. Like, they've always kind of jumped into a space, maybe not gotten it right in version one, but sort of iterated and revised and improved every single year until they owned it, you know?
They definitely want in on the camera space, and they've got a bunch of models now, and they represent a lot of new thinking, and they are saying, look, we don't care what's come before. We're going to put out our take on this.
And it's not just them. Like, the entire camera space is being revolutionized and democratized in the same way that Post was.
Yeah.
So you've got, you know, AJA, that's a little bit higher pricing and maybe a little bit more of a premium over the Blackmagic device. But you've also got, like, Sony doing insane deals with, like, the F5 and the 55. Where now you can buy an F5 and you can upgrade it to the F55 at any time.
Now, Sony has Post formats in them, like ProRes, DXHD. It's like, what are we in, Bizarro land?
Right. Yeah. And even Arri has had to, like, you know, they've got the Amira coming out finally. Right. It's a lower-cost camera. Like, everybody's sort of adapting to this new reality. For us, it's great because we're getting better images into our... online, right? If you have something that's shot on the F55 or the 5, you know, in a reality shoot scenario, that's recorded in ProRes, that means your workflow, Josh, is really easy.
Yeah.
You're going to be getting great latitude from that SL3, S-Gamma 3 image. But by that same token, that camera might be 14 and a half stops or whatever. You know, you might have something from Blackmagic that's 12 stops, but it's also going to be a very convenient record format, really easy workflows. I mean, the advantages are tremendous for us in terms of post-production.
So the thing that's interesting is that as much as the cameras are exciting for production, they're a big deal for us in post. And they're very post-friendly. A lot of them are turning out to be.
And I think, Jason, you and I went to Codex and talked to developer Baselight and a little bit about what they're thinking is. One of the things they're hearing from their customers is they're seeing facilities that were traditionally strictly post-production going more and more into production. So those two things are kind of merging together. And there's a lot of interaction between the kind of stuff you need to do in production and the stuff you would traditionally do in post.
Yeah.
And companies that were, again, traditionally post companies are starting to do production themselves. You're doing some of that now, right?
Yeah, myself. And the company that I've been working with for the last 6 weeks is exactly that. They were formerly an Avid house. They have about 10 or 12 people, 5 bays, 2 online bays. And as a way to keep their customers, very honestly, to keep work that was coming to them possibly in-house, they started stretching into onset, and now they do full-on productions, including, you know, production management and the creative, you know, the origination of ideas for these clients they have. And what we were learning at the Codex booth is that these companies who are moving into production are not only doing that in order to broaden what they offer, but as a competitive move to make sure that they can have a stake early on in the process, and it's gotten so far as that they're now, you know, on set.
Well, it's an extension of the democratization. So as we're seeing that democratization in post-production, we're seeing it extend into production and with these cameras, and it's also changing the shape of how we're doing things. And another extension of that democratization is kind of that pricing structure. One of the big announcements last week that we saw was from Digital Vision announcing a change in their lineup. They're getting rid of the Filmmaster concept, the platform, and changing it to just Nikoda. And they're also drastically changing the way they were doing pricing. And it looked like what we were going to be seeing was a Filmmaster that was going to be $2,700 US. But I think you saw a demo, and maybe that's a little bit off.
Yeah, so I spent actually a couple of hours at the Digital Vision sort of suite over at the Renaissance, and we were able to talk with those guys, and I think that one of the things that's really good is that they've been observing the market like a lot of companies, and they've now decided to sort of make a decision. And one of the things that's sort of the large change is a change in their pricing structure. Long story short is that there is an entry-level product, and it's not the full Nikoda system. It's actually Nikoda Look. So Fuse, which was a product they had before, looks like that's being deprecated. Nikoda Look, which is a single-layer color corrector, it's essentially an on-set product, is going to be the entry level.
Daily's product.
The entry level, you know. And then there is the more full-featured product, which we would want, a finishing product, multi-layer timeline, that also includes the DVO Classic bundle. And essentially, that product combined with the DVS Atomics LT board will get you what everyone looks at as a full-featured finishing color corrector. So the thought would be that one of the other things you need is a PC capable of running it, Filmmaster, or I guess Nucoda is very storage intensive, so you need a good RAID array. The other thing that's really important to note is that there is subscription or essentially support that you would have to pay after your initial purchase. So you get 1 year of free updates, and then if you wanted to continue updates into new versions, after that year you'd have to pay a yearly cost, which depending on the level of support you want, this could be everything from a person that you could actually call on the phone 24 hours a day, plus hardware, as well as updates, all the way down to just software updates only. So they have about four tiers of support. So depending on your requirements as an individual user or a facility, you'd be able to pick from these four different options for support, and you'd pay these yearly, and you'd have to just calculate that into the total cost. So
how many pesos would that be then?
I think that's 100,297
pesos. Since we are in Paliso, I've got to put it in those terms
well,
as well.
Then you have to factor in which kind of pesos. Yeah. That can vary widely. It's interesting. I mean, if this had been, I think, a bit more clear in the original announcement, it would still be a shocking change.
Yeah.
It's a little bit less shocking just because of the impression, I think, from the original announcement, which was a little different.
Well, look, they got us all talking about it.
They did.
Absolutely.
The posts on LGG about Nucoda have gone up like 57,000% for the year. So, yes, absolutely. And they have a fine product. There's no doubt that it's a very capable color correction system. The conforming from Avid seems phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you are an Avid shop, and you want to just do a color and conform within that kind of closed loop of being an Avid shop, this is probably your best pick.
Especially if you're really bummed out about DS being gone. Those are the people that are like, because they already have, is it a ZA20?
A lot of them do, yeah. They'll have a Z800 or ZA20. And
well,
one of the big things they're looking
for. That's not required, right? It'll work on a generic PC.
It will.
But if they're on a DS and they already had it, then it's already, like, you're
they've already got
halfway
the,
there.
Yeah.
So the challenge for, you know, people say in that situation on DS, you know, they were looking for products that would do a couple things. They needed something that was a capable finishing tool, something that would conform really wonderfully and seamlessly from Media Composer, and something that would work on their hardware. And actually, you know, Nucoda fulfills those three big requirements. So that might be a nice option.
I mean, it would be smart. I think of Avid to sort of push this as the solution to the 4K problem for
it
them,
would,
or at least,
really
or at least a stopgap.
Yeah.
If Avid was in better shape, and we can get into what's going on in Avid, but if Avid was in better shape, you would say like this would be a prime pickup opportunity for them to sort of get this on board and offer it as a bundle with the software. I mean, the way that Adobe has done with SpeedGrade as a way to, or Apple did with Color, as a way to sort of round out their capabilities.
Yeah.
But it's tremendous software. The pricing reduction is even given first impressions, I think the pricing reduction here is tremendous. It's really kind of changing the whole dynamic of what's possible.
And the other thing that's going to be really interesting is you've had, you know, the situation as it's been for the past couple of years with DaVinci Resolve pricing. And so you see the Digital Vision guys presenting their options. And I wonder if this is going to make other companies possibly, you know, either look to make products that fit in that price bracket, or to, you know, adjust their pricing scale in some way. Now, one of the things that's been a really common comment among a bunch of people that I've spoken with is just a lot of people don't want to see the bottom fall out of the price of these things. A lot of people are saying, look, I want to pay for a good product. I don't necessarily want it to be bottom dollar. I feel like I am at a point where I'm willing to pay for a certain amount of astute functionality. But people are relating the price of the products a lot with the kind of current situation we're in, And, you know, there's an argument back and forth about that. You know?
Well, here's the thing. You ultimately kind of get what you pay for no matter what, right? So a very mass market broad product has to carefully weigh which customers it kind of will satisfy or how much effort, you know, has to weigh the effort reward very carefully, right? That, you know, this is something that's going to take a lot of effort, but in order to do it, it's going to have to satisfy a lot of our customers. Otherwise, it's not worth the amount of effort that it's going to take. Whereas a product that's targeted more at a narrow set of customers will be more apt to then tackle the difficult things for those customers because they benefit from them. You know, it's when you're talking about the extreme high end of these things, like, you know, the Quantels, the Mysticas, the Baselights. Yeah, you're talking about products where individual customers that are buying four or five seats can request specific R&D to be done and put it into contracts and get it. They can say, we need this function, and they'll do it. That's a bit tougher a case to make when you're buying a $9.95 dongle or downloading the software for free.
You could ask.
You can always ask, but it's just you can't get a contract that says we're going to do this by this time.
The other big thing that's been brought up by a number of manufacturers, and when we talk about price, the topic that comes up right after price is how much support do we offer?
Yeah.
If they're scared about any one thing, it's going to be the manpower required to either provide the kind of support that they have in the past, which is really fantastic, possibly 24/7, very, you know, like 4-hour response support.
Yeah.
And they're scared about the idea of trying to do something like that for a larger user base at a lower cost. So I think one of the things that's going to allow any kind of price changes to sort of be a long-term feature of the software we're looking at is the idea that we as customers would take on more of the support ourselves or be okay with the idea of email or 24-hour response time or something like that.
Right.
That's not nearly as concierge as it was for
the high-end. Well, you can see that in the kind of the resolve support, right?
Yeah.
And the counterpoint to that is if you stick to the parameters that they lay out within the config guides, you're in fairly good shape and you have a really supportable system. But then you have a lot of people going, oh, I have this old card, graphics card I want to use. Why doesn't it support it or whatever? So the other issue is when you're talking about kind of commoditized pricing, like what Filmmaster or Nakoda, is ultimately looking at, you're also talking about commoditized hardware. And so that means that, you know, you're not going to always be installed on that ZA20. You're sometimes going to be installed on somebody's home-built PC, and then, you know, that's a whole other nightmare of support, because every little thing can be a factor in how well that system performs.
Yeah.
One interesting thing I think I saw from Baselight, actually, from Filmlight, was the Baselight Dailies tool, which, speaking of commoditized hardware, like, that's running on a Mac, which is kind of new for them, and they're doing some really cool things in terms of the way they interact their grading environment with the editorial environment, where they're expanding their Baselight Editions plugin now to support BLGs and load them based on timecode and metadata, source metadata from the clips. Hmm. So in an Avid timeline, you can take a filler clip, put your Baselight grade on it, on that, have your cut underneath it, and then within the Baselight application, you'll be able to go into this lens mode. And in that mode, you'll point it to a directory of BLG files, and it'll look for BLG files that match the source real name and time code from the clip underneath it, and then apply the appropriate time, the appropriate grade to the appropriate shot. So that means you can have a separate colorist in Baselight Dailies, for example, going through and grading the source shots. Meanwhile, the editor is always seeing the latest look in their cut.
That's cool. That is pretty cool.
So it's really extracting the idea of the timeline from the application, and the timeline and conform as being part of the colorist job, and it's making it much more kind of metadata driven and making that invisible to the editorial.
So that's a good segue into shared databases now in Resolve as well, which is pretty exciting because that's the same idea. Now that they have this
editor
in it, now they're talking about how to share that database back and forth.
I can't tell you how happy I am with just with ProRes on the Linux platform is something that's like huge. Like, you have no idea how enormous that is. and makes a huge
what
difference.
What made that possible? Like, what was holding them back? Was it technical, or was it...
No, I don't want to bring up a source spot, but if you recall, there was a beta that accidentally left the ProRes functionality in it. And so, obviously, this has been something that's kind of ongoing, and there's, you know, question of when you're working with a third party like Apple that owns the codec, that's a proprietary piece of technology, you have to be able to license things and work that way. And so, sometimes it's not a matter of sort of first party, but more third party. But it's great to finally see. I mean, I think that to me is the biggest theme from NAB this year is everybody gets ProRes.
Yeah.
Quantel's got ProRes.
Sony.
Nakoda's got ProRes. Sony's got ProRes. AJ's got ProRes. Assimilate has ProRes. Who else? The Blackmagic DaVinci Resolve has ProRes.
So is that a coincidence or is that a planned thing?
Well, clearly not a coincidence, right? Clearly there's a pattern here. I mean, I think it suggests that there's been a change in attitude maybe from Apple from what they've done in the past. I think it's pretty cool. Going forward, I hope we see a lot more products that have this ProRes. I think it's good for Apple. I think it's certainly good for the idea of ProRes as a mastering platform. It makes it, you know, makes the push for not using ProRes or using ProRes from third-party sources less relevant, right? There's really no reason now to use FFmpeg ProRes if you're able to get a fully functioning license from Apple to do ProRes natively in your app. And so that's huge. And then the second thing that's awesome to me, like from my side, is the shared database and collaborative work. Because what that means is we're already seeing improvements in the way Resolve works with the timeline. And so now it's not inconceivable to say do a whole feature in one go in a timeline, which in versions previous you would not have done in Resolve. Now you can do that. But it's still kind of advantageous to break it up into reels just because you can have somebody working on reel 2 while you're upgrading reel 1 or vice versa or whatever. Now, you would be able to have a conform artist do the conform while you've already started grading. So that look session can take place at the same time as the conform session. That's huge. That's a day saved. That's tremendous and a feature that can make a huge, huge difference. So that's really, really awesome. I think that's phenomenal and a great way to take advantage of the shared project.
Yeah.
A great feature to add to the dongle version.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the differences between the dongle version and the light version were just kind of diminishing. That's a great pro feature.
Right, because that's really remote grading in a nutshell. I mean, that's
it's beyond remote grading, because in remote grading... If you were in a remote grading scenario and you needed to make a change to the sequence, you would break the remote session.
Oh.
So this is actually a step above remote grading. I mean, Resolve has always worked in this way where the kind of the metadata of the grade is separate from the edit data, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's always had that remote grades in the associated with the media source media. What this is an extension of that, which is to say, why couldn't we, if the two things are separate, why couldn't we modify one while you're modifying another? Because the two things don't really relate.
Right.
What I don't think you'll be able to do is grade on one end of a show and while somebody else is grading on another end of a show. You'd still need to kind of work in separate projects for that. But having somebody, you know, go through and check the conform, adjust pan, tilt, zoom, you know, get the edits, plug in VFX shots as we're kind of doing looks and work in the same project. Huge. That is awesome. What else is phenomenal? New mat tools. You can do mat cleanup now, so you can like do despeckling. You can do a little white clipping, black clipping in the mats. That's pretty great.
Highlight recovery looks really cool, and shadow recovery.
It's really cool, but that's something we've been doing for years. Like, I've been doing that for a while. But it's just like, it's nice to make it easy for people. Oh, the automatic shot balancing. So now all you have to do is get people to actually shoot a color chart. which we know that happens all the time.
All the time.
Constantly having to like, wow. I'm like, guys, I don't need 10 minutes of color chart in this shot. You can just start recording.
And please stop slating it or naming your clips.
Don't mark it with a clap or anything. Nothing. No, guys, come on.
Yeah.
No. Hopefully, we can get people to start.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. But it's cool that you can if you have a color chart, you can. Within a function in Resolve now, you can line it up, match the color, and then have it basically recreate the real-world color within the Resolve environment. That's pretty cool.
Right. Small victory for me, being able to type in time code without a panel. Without a panel. Yeah. Without a big boy panel.
That's great. What features are jumping out
of you? I like the LAB color. I mean, LAB in a node, which is really cool.
Lab.
So you can really get some neat looks out of that too, and it's a good utility thing too. So that's pretty neat.
One of the other big ones that's a win for Jake Blackstone possibly the render cache.
Oh, that's huge.
Resolve now has a very advanced render cache,
and you can use ProRes in the render cache
as the intermediate format,
which is awesome because that means that DPX is kind of tough to deal with. It's huge files, and even though it's really fast and speedy and stable, there's the disadvantage of kind of.
And just to point it out, they call it a multi-point render cache. So, you can render cache a node.
There is.
A whole clip.
Correct.
And then there's a thought of what are the other points?
No, there's a debayer. There's a debayer cache. There's a node cache, which you can kind of set what node it's going to be on. Yeah. And then you can do it manually or you can do it automatically.
Right.
And then there's a the existing sort of timeline cache, which would cover motion effects and that kind of stuff.
And so the one thing that a lot of people said, Resolve was lacking was something that would allow Resolve to not necessarily be completely real-time on every single front. Like, Resolve has always had a very strong real-time component with the GPU and CPU support, but there is a thought, especially with 4K, especially with some of these new camera formats, that on many machines, that could, be an overwhelming task, even for Resolve on a well-spec machine. And so now RenderCache allows you to just bulldoze through a lot of those barriers.
Oh, group clip grading?
Right.
That one's huge, too.
Like, astronomically huge.
That changes how you work in the system.
I've been asking for that since Resolve 8.
Yeah.
And
where had you seen that before?
Well, I mean, the big issue that we had before was the grouping was broken as a function because you couldn't really adjust your grouping once you grouped, right? So you were kind of locked in, and the workaround was to sort of ungroup, then make an adjustment, then regroup. Very clunky. So what the new change allows you to do is, one, it's easier to create groups, right? You can just select a bunch of clips, go create a new group, and that function works a much more pleasant way. And then beyond that, you're now able to go into a mode, like you have the track mode, you're able to go into a group pre-clip grade, and then a group post-clip grade, or post-group grade, which is a grade that's occurring before for that individual clip, before the group grade, and a grade that's occurring for that individual clip.
For touch-ups, specifically for that.
So, the situations where you would want to do this, if, for example, you have a look that you've created and you apply that as a group, and then you want to do a balance pass, sort of adjusting the luminance level for the exposure for all of those clips, you can go through and adjust the pre-clip group pre-clip grade on each of those clips to set the balance. And then if you find, this look is kind of lifting the blacks a little bit too much on this one shot, you can go into the
post
grade and sort of bring
adjust
the blacks
back down.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
I mean, it's definitely, what you can tell is a couple things. First off, the product roadmap for Resolve is very well thought out. And there is a nice number of features that feel like they came directly from, user requests.
Yeah.
So time code, the render cache.
The ability to use two screens.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The ability to sort of move stuff around a little
bit. And that's really commendable.
Full screen on the second monitor.
Yeah.
I mean,
even OFX plugins. I mean, that's pretty.
Right. That was a user request. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
They'd listen.
They're very proactive on both their customer front and on their own ideas, and it's really...
It's pretty impressive what they do in terms of balancing. They also do a really nice job balancing the direction, the overall direction for the company onto the Resolve product. Clearly, Resolve is a critical core component for Blackmagic, right? It's a free product, but yet it seems to be tied into everything that they're doing. It's tied into the camera, it's tied into the scanner, it's tied into their decklink cards, it's tied into their strategy.
Yeah, everything.
And so
it gives reason for everything.
It's the glue that holds the company together in a way.
Yeah.
And so it's become a really critical core product for them. And they clearly put a lot of effort into developing it. It's not a product that is being kind of left to sort of wither on the vine here. Or, you know, they've created something great and we're just going to leave it alone. They're always sort of retouching it and improving it.
And that's something their competitors don't have. Like, you know, AGA does not have software that they sell at all.
Sure.
So, I mean, it's a big way to differentiate themselves, you know?
Yeah, and it also gives them experience in a practical sense of how their hardware is being applied, right?
Yeah.
So that's great, great for them. And I mean, you know, you gotta love Resolve. I mean, you can't be mad at you.
And then sort of, you know, speaking of things to tie together, I guess now everybody can have a UHD scanner in their fashionable modern home living room as well.
It's sort of interesting because what they've set up with the scanner is they're kind of trying to get user feedback on it, and they've not set a date for shipping for it. It's a tricky market. You can see there's a value in archival scanning for sure. It's the tough part is the mechanics of the scanner need to be really critical, and so you need like the option of having a no contact gate. You need certain critical components in that for that device to really take off. But at $30,000, it's an insane value.
What do you think about the? Am I right in that it is limited to UHD scanning?
That's correct.
Non-cinema frame sizes, is that an issue?
Yeah, you could conceive of that. I mean, most of the 35mm content is going to be 185, and the question is, like, how do you adapt
that? Yeah, and I think that they're mainly there for TV, you know what I mean? They're really not looking to re-release these in a cinema.
Right.
So I think that's okay.
So that's a great point. The idea that the direction these films that are being scanned might likely go...
I mean, I think you can think of archival. I think UHD would be fine for archival purposes if you're looking at something that's like shot on 35mm and you want long-term sort of storage because you're not sure if you're going to be able to play that 35mm anymore, right? So UHD is just a way to kind of be able to screen the film, even in a theater, is not a bad way to go. Would it be nice to have a 4K sensor on there? Probably. I don't think the specs are really final on that device.
Yeah.
So
it was kind of like a sort of a technology statement, if anything.
Yeah.
That by the way, we are doing something with that purchase.
Yeah.
Well, and it's been a while too. They've,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. Like 2 years now, right?
Or like a little over a year. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of other, you know, big news, maybe.
I think
from
small
other companies.
News. I mean, I didn't get a chance to really talk to those guys, but FSI showing their OLEDs, which are phenomenal screens. Really tremendous screens. Like if you're gonna buy a monitor and you're looking for something that's, you know, solid and it's gonna be kind of useful for years and years to come, I think that's probably the one to go with. In terms of feature set, it's tremendous feature set at a really reasonable price. But they've also got like a new little 9-inch monitor that's HD. I'm looking forward to seeing that to see if that could be my new like recommendation for somebody that's like, what's the cheapest monitor I can get that'll work? I'm like, well, there's this 9-inch monitor. It's full res HD.
That's right.
Get that. Go get a magnifying glass.
Yeah.
Speaking of, support on Mac, an interesting thing that's come out is Flame Premium 2015.
Oh, yeah.
Which a lot of people were excited about because...
With the Flame Assist.
With Flame Assist. So a couple things. Flame Premium now actually takes on a second GPU,
mm-hmm.
which is a theme that's being shared by a couple other companies. Actually, Mystica is capable of doing that now too.
Wow.
And so what they're doing is they aren't spanning across the GPUs in the same way, say, Resolve does, or I guess Baselite. What they're doing is they're using that second GPU, kind of like a sidecar GPU, that's being used for either background rendering or for decoding and debayering.
Oh, cool.
So, for instance, on a number of products, that would be the second GPU would be used for GPU debayering red.
Yeah.
And then on Flame specifically,
which is worth noting, is CPU heavy.
Still. It is very. It's still
so
very.
So it's gonna like suck up your CPU in the background when you're
right.
Work
so
with.
You do have to watch out. But I guess at least it's a move away from the single GPU.
Yeah.
The other thing that's really nice is on a Flame at least you've got this situation called Shot Reactor, which is a lot like sort of render cache on Resolve or New Coda. Which is this idea that as you work through your compositing or grading timeline, you've got shots are rapidly being rendered for real-time review later the moment you move away from them. So it's a very automatic sort of render that was before you needed to implement in another machine in a machine room. So, you know, in the Flame world, you have these incinerator or burn nodes that would be, you know, set up across a 10 gigabit Ethernet network or InfiniBand. And that was a kind of a complex setup. So now people who would just like, you know, a bit of that background rendering don't need to go to that complexity. They can just set it up in a single GPU in their workstation, and that's a nice benefit.
So but, does this mean Backburner is off the table? Or is this
no, but Backburner still exists, and I think it still manages even the processes within the machine. Uh-huh. But the thought is that it's now easier to implement some form of background rendering so that when you're in those really, you know, fast client attend sessions, you can be working on shots, and anything that you just touched up is going to be rendered so it'll play back, you know. And so one of the big things that we're not just talking about sort of color changes, but also, you know, 5, 10, and 20 layer deep compositing that can be baked in so that it can be played back quickly without necessarily having to set up a render cluster or node.
It's very funny that one of the themes, it seems like, this NAB is caching.
Caching,
yeah.
And ProRes.
And ProRes.
non-OS 10, you know, based ProRes.
Which, I mean, you would think, like, as processors and GPUs get faster and drives get faster, like, caching would be less and less of a concern.
But 4K...
makes it a concern again.
Yeah,
all of a sudden we're like... whoa, we need caching on our Macs and on our...
And also the expectations that people are, you know, there's this thought with the denoise algorithms, you know, optical flow retiming, and all of the things that are being added that were not really accessible to this layer of the market.
What's happened
all
is
of these things are CPU, GPU intensive.
That kind of technology was around years ago, but it was so computationally taxing that you wouldn't really conceive of using it on, like, a regular slow-mo unless you really need it. Like, you wouldn't use optical flow if you were doing a 50% slow-mo.
It was a very special case.
Right. You would be like, we really need high-quality slow-mo here, so we'll use the optical flow.
And there would be a person, literally, that would be offline with that footage to just do that task.
And doing it for hours and hours.
And now we're sprinkling it over everything.
Now we're doing it in the color session.
Yeah,
even.
Exactly.
And because we're able to...
On the go.
Because we're able to use it, do it on the GPUs.
Yeah.
But it's still taxing.
Yeah. And so with that... another thing that people have used is classically on these big, you know, hero workstations is an assist station.
Yeah.
So Baselite has a assist station for Mac, I guess.
That's huge.
And now Flame Premium has Flame Assist, which is an OS X based Flame.
Right. This is the Mac OS X Flame, and it's only available for you if you have the Flame
Premium license.
Not a Flame license, but a Flame Premium license.
Premium, yeah.
And I think it's free. Like, it comes with the license.
Yeah.
And what it basically lets you do is have a it's just the functionality is a smoke.
It's a smoke on Mac.
But in the future, what this allows them to do is have a clean divide between the Flame product and the smoke product. So you could see functionality developing in that Flame Assist station that doesn't exist in the smoke station.
Yeah.
But today, right now, it's the same functionality.
Yeah.
But it's still like it's a free smoke for people doing Flame.
And I think the bigger thing that it represents is Autodesk taking at least a tiptoe into certain systems products, which were strictly Linux or before that, you know, Irix, SGI. They're now sort of, you know, creating code for OS X, and so that could lead to other things.
Yeah,
so,
it also says that the Flame code now runs on OS X.
Yeah, yeah, and so that's a nice progression that hopefully will, you know, bear, you know, fruit in a lot of other
areas. It was interesting to see, like, you know, when they announced Mac 2013, they had the ConnectFX module, which everyone was like, this is Batch.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're like, yeah, but it's not Batch because we're not calling it Batch. It's ConnectFX. But yeah, but it's Batch. And they're like, no, it's ConnectFX. Well, it looks like Batch. It sounds like Batch. It walks like Batch.
Technically speaking, the reason it's ConnectFX and not purely Batch, even though it has the nodes, most of the nodes and the basic, you know, functionality of Batch, is that it's tied to the timeline.
Okay.
Whereas Batch, you can just open up a panel.
But this is kind of a distinction
without
a difference.
A clip. and then it doesn't have to exist in the timeline. But that's
truly the flame in general,
thing.
Anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but now that they've kind of broken the two, it would be conceivable that Flame Assist would now have Batch.
Exactly. Right. Yes.
But it's interesting to see them actually kind of delve further into the Mac development.
Yep.
It will be interesting to see now that Flame has a timeline inside of Flame, what becomes of Smoke.
Yeah,
exactly. And well, that's the other thing too, is that, you know, a lot of people were very concerned about Smoke because the last official update was quite a while ago, and it was Smoke 2013. So now we finally have Smoke 2015. And one of the big requests that people had for Smoke was more real-time more real-time performance. So all the timeline-based effects are now what we'll call GPU-accelerated in a way that there is less rendering. And then the other big thing is it now has a 3D tracker. So if you're doing compositing, that means that you can finally do 3D tracking within Smoke and not have to go out to like a planar tracker like Mocha or Matchmove or something like that.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
It is for anybody doing some real, like, for instance, 3D tracking is really useful if you want to place text into a scene and have the text rotate with the scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's critical for, tons of stuff.
Now, if you're doing serious compositing in any capacity,
it's a requirement, and it was probably the number one gripe of advanced users, and now it's finally been added. So
do we...
We didn't touch Avid at all.
We didn't touch Avid. We haven't touched SpeedGrade either.
I guess, what is the situation with Avid? I actually have not...
They have a subscription model now. That's a new thing.
Yeah, I think that'll piss the Creative Cloud people all over again. I mean, right now they sell both perpetual license and subscription license, but you could conceive of that being a temporary. I mean, for a while, Adobe had subscription and permanent licenses as well.
But it fulfills the same need as Adobe does. But I mean, you know, Avid shops pop up and then close up all the time. You know, as you know, shows come and go, so it makes a lot of sense.
I mean, for like 51 Minds, it makes a lot of sense to be able to scale really quickly. So they have a new show come in, they need 50 seats, they can do that and only pay for that month, and it's great for them.
Absolutely.
Now, that does that mean lost revenue for Avid, though?
Because
would they have otherwise sold 50 seats instead of renting them for that month?
Well, it depends. I mean, some of that is still rental. There's a lot of moving parts in it as well, too. So
does this hurt, like, the Avid rental business?
I mean, I think the Avid rental business in general is going to have a hard time because, it all runs on off-the-shelf hardware. I mean, you could even plug an iMac in.
Sure.
And have a running
editorial
Avid.
Is not a hard thing to run.
No. So I think that it makes it really difficult for a rental company.
Particularly an editor that can't do UHD.
Right.
You know, like, that does not take a lot of processing power to run an Avid, basically.
It's pretty clear, like, what their business is storage. Yeah. That's what it comes down to. And, I mean, I really thought that they should have just given away all the software as they did with Blackmagic. Think about how well it did for their hardware and what it could have done for Avid. But they didn't. They decided to sell it. And because they're a publicly traded company.
Yeah.
That might have had something to do with it.
Well, they're not anymore.
They're not.
I guess they are publicly traded.
Well, they're delisted traded company. Yeah.
Right. So.
They're a penny stock now. I mean, they're not pennies.
I think it's what is... It's
off market.
Off market or, you know.
It's a wild state of things that...
Color-wise, like... There's nothing happening with Avid. Like, it's really clear that they don't have any interest in improving things or changing things.
And you can see why would they when there's somebody like Blackmagic on...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Announcements really seem to be focused around, you know, their movement of Interplay, you know, Sphere toward their sort of cloud solution now. I mean, it seemed like they have 5 or 6 new products and they're all sort of these,
I have to say, I feel like they're...
Cloud MAM-based collaboration tools.
Their announcements were really vague and kind of really well disguised in, like, marketing gobbledygook.
Synergy.
Yeah, no, it really was. And it's like, I think what people want from Avid is just nuts and bolts improvement.
Right.
Functionality that they need.
Yeah.
You can adjust pricing, and the subscription thing is powerful. And certainly, like, the collaborative stuff is powerful. But just, you know, you gotta, it's not just about what you sell, it's also about how you sell it. And you gotta make that case clear for the customer or the user. And I don't know if they, maybe we are misinterpreting who their customer is, because maybe we're, as editors, are not their customer. It's
yes.
more.
They definitely
else.
Have an enterprise focus.
Yeah.
They really feel like that's where they'll be successful. It seems in the long term. It's,
yeah.
They're not trying to do onesie twosies. Although you can buy things on their web store, you know, that's sort of automated, you know, internet income. And where they put their effort and their ground forces is definitely into big institutions and,
right.
you know, news stations and the government and a lot
but
of other
gotta
large companies.
But they got to be careful because, like, Premier is stealing a lot of that stuff away now, too.
It's pecking away at it, that's
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
And let's just say that it's 2014. There's still no higher than HD solution from Avid at all. And the one solution they had, which was DS,
yeah.
they dumped.
Yeah.
So how much longer can they really be a force to contend with without an answer to that question?
When I think of it in a visual sense, I think of it as like a little kid holding their breath underwater. It's like,
yeah.
how long can they stay before they come
yeah.
up and tell us 4K is available?
Yeah.
You know, and so the thing is that I think they're almost going to move into a place where if they don't address it, like say, yes, we will have something or no, we won't, that's going to do more damage. Just the sheer silence. I know Autodesk, you know, had some people very frustrated on the smoke 2013 silence. There were people who were worried about whether they could, you know, continue to invest in it or look at it as a product that they needed to replace very soon. So they've answered that now. But, you know, Avid at some point will be, people are just going to move on without them, without an answer at some point coming up.
What they could do, too, is they could just own the fact that they are not a finishing tool. That Symphony actually is not a finishing tool. And that you need to finish in something else.
Yeah,
and
there's
make
a ton
recommendation.
Of television being finished
yeah.
in Symphony, though.
Yeah, that's true.
What would be great is, let's say Avid makes a clear-cut decision that, you know, high resolutions are not something that they're going to tackle on their own, and they do a really nice strategic partnership with any of a number of great companies. It could be, you know, Filmlight, or it could be Digital Vision, or
okay,
whomever.
So take Arri, for instance. They're still only recording 2.5K. Mm-hmm. I mean, so even them, they're a holdout as well.
But they are working on a 4K camera.
There's a 6K Arri camera.
Well, you know what? That's news, too.
it's actually like, I don't want to get too much into it, because it's apparently a prototype.
It's a GoPro.
Yes, it's a GoPro.
6K GoPro.
It's a, so what they've done is they've basically, like, it's a 65mm sized sensor. Like, it's a large format type sensor. So it only works with certain lenses. And in essence, what it is, it's four
of
their 2.5K
chips. Their 2.5K chips together. Yeah, that's very
interesting. Or 3K chips.
Stitched together.
I mean, I don't know if that's literally what it is,
but it's along those lines.
Yeah. So, I mean, we let's cover the other big A, Adobe.
Right.
They're clearly, kind of, Premiere is clearly gaining steam. I think, you know, I'm seeing more Premiere stuff coming in. You're probably seeing more Premiere stuff coming in. Obviously, the low end of the market, sort of, you know, Premiere is kind of their solution. FCPX and Premiere, but even the middle end and then some of the high end stuff, it's going towards Premiere. It seems they're doing really well there. The interface with SpeedGrade has been improved, but it seems like the SpeedGrade improvements have been slow and incremental, and
not, they don't have the same priority and sort of the man hours put into them on a year-to-year basis as other things like Premiere,
the
After Effects.
Is not a yeah. improved. Like, they're not gaining speed, pardon the pun.
Right. The features that they're putting in there for color are yeah. for editors who want to color.
Right.
And they very well should have that be the target of the
right.
product. But if they want to do that, then what they need to worry about is interface design, which they don't seem to be changing it a lot.
Although they've improved it. Last year they improved the SpeedGrade interface quite a bit.
Yeah.
Give them credit. And there's some nice, you know, the multi-view features.
I would say they've been small improvements. I mean, the thing you get at is, I think that interface as it stands today is not an interface that's editor friendly.
Yeah.
And if that's the product they want to sell, and it makes sense for them to want to do it, right? If what you want to do is create an environment, and what Adobe seems to be doing is creating an environment where you can be in their ecosystem and do everything end to end, right?
Right.
And do it yourself for the most part. And so if they want SpeedGrade to be the tool for editors who do color, and there's nothing wrong with that, that's great, then they should design the tool for editors who want to do color. And the tool for editors who want to do color is not a tool that was designed for on-set, you know, quickly doing dailies or whatever. That interface needs to be really different and really rethought. What they're missing is the kind of reimagining of the interface and the experience that they need to do in order to really make this a product that works for their market.
And you know what else it could be? I mean, when people aren't working on a product, it's great evidence that their quiet target is elsewhere, you know, and maybe they've got this concept where they're going to integrate some sort of SpeedGrade functionality actually to make looks and do grades, you know, in Premiere. So yeah. They've got this ability to update.
As it happened with Final Cut.
I think you can do, like, for instance, After Effects text updates within Premiere.
Well.
And then maybe there's a possibility that you're going to have, like, a lift gamma gain and, you know, various. They already have the plugins themselves, but maybe there's going to be a way to do Lumetri tweaks within SpeedGrade without necessarily having to go to SpeedGrade.
Within Premiere
without going to SpeedGrade.
Popping in and out of the application.
Yeah.
I mean, in any case, I do think that, like, if you're gonna make a application for color for editors to do color, if that is what their target is, and I think it should be, I think that would be a smart move for them. Then I think the model isn't so much the kind of assimilate-y type interface that SpeedGrade has, but more of the, I think, the magic bullet looks type interface where it's
sure.
Yeah. So
I like assimilate-y. Interfaces.
Assimilate-y interfaces?
Assimilate-y.
Did you go to Assimilate yet?
You know what? They recently released Scratch 8.
Yeah.
And, you know, the really...
ProRes.
ProRes on Windows, one of the companies that's gone and added that now. The big thing that seems like, you know, Scratch is now very sort of cloud-aware and also very collaborative. So most of their recent efforts are focused around collaboration between Scratch... and other scratches, and a lot of what we'll call remote grading type, you know, options. So what this is not necessarily you have two scratches, one with an operator and one with the client at a distance. It's more the idea that you would have Scratch on one end, and then you know, an ability to send to, like, say, an iPad or some other monitor, you know, a compressed but color accurate version of the grade, as well as the ability to sync all of the grade data between two scratches, with the hope that at both ends, you know, each you know, user would have the same media. And so they are working very hard on metadata transfer between scratches, the ability for people to, you know, remote into Scratch both ways, and to either take control of a scratch from a distance or to be able to view another scratch at a remote location. And so, you know, where those tools, you know, lead Scratch, it hasn't been seen yet, really, because it's just been released. But again, it's kind of like a lot of companies attempting to do, you know, these collaborative cloud-based features like, you know, Resolve is and other companies. And so who knows? It could be something that becomes really popular and, you know, gives Scratch users, you know, remote grading options and the ability to work together in a really elegant way.
Yeah, I think one big overarching question for color is kind of the relevance to the on-set stuff, and I think that that's kind of one answer, is like finding ways to get our fingers as colorists on the cart,
yeah.
You know, and without having to sit there all day and wait for the footage to come in.
Yeah.
So if there's the solution that is effective, that works for giving a colorist the ability to say remote into some, an on-set cart over an LTE, you know, access point or something like that. Look at an image in a way that can actually lead to a good level of understanding about the image.
Right.
Make adjustments, sort of set a look for it, and then have more of a technician then apply that and generate the dailies on the set. I think that's a nice combo.
Yeah, and I think there are things like metadata-based grade transfer. remote grading is sort of popular in certain sectors, but like this nascent market. And then this ability to sync, you know, data between finishing or DIT and a finishing station. These are all things that aren't mainstream yet. And so I think one of the big things about this NAB is we really feel like new concepts, for instance, Blackmagic with their cameras, AJ doing cameras, the cloud features that Avid has implemented, Media Composer, the cloud features that Scratch has implemented, the metadata-based grading in Premiere, SpeedGrade, and also in things like Baselight dailies with full Baselight. You know, these are all attempts to sort of propel what we're doing right now forward. And so it'll be really interesting to see which of these take off, because there's a good chance, you know, a lot of us will be using some of these things next year.
It's true.
Yeah. And then, you know, to see all the people at the Colorist Mixer, that was a lot of fun. You know, it was put on by Mixing Light guys and ICA, which was great. But I didn't think that Blackmagic would introduce so many new products again. I was surprised at the Autodesk announcements. There's a lot of other things going on with monitors and, you know, the ProRes support across so many Windows products now.
Yeah.
So I came really thinking this was going to be an ordinary NAB, and it's actually been, you know, kind of exceptional.
Yeah.
So what about you guys?
I think this is a rebuilding year for like NAB. It's a little bit of kind of like a let's mature things and let's refine stuff. I think you can see that in sort of the progression of the cameras. I think from the post side, it's maybe Resolve is huge and Nakota is huge, but you know, not a crazy year. I think a good year to have a big flame revision, because I think that's big news now in a way that it might not have been other years. We have you know, big changes from Adobe. What we're seeing from Adobe is kind of a different strategy, where they're kind of like focusing more on kind of not small in terms of scope, but small in terms of headlines, but small but useful changes that really refine and improve the products that they have, which I think is great, for particularly for their editorial products.
And they really feel like that's a focus that they were longing for, that the subscription model has enabled.
And on the flip side of that, you have Blackmagic doing like crazy stuff every year, where you're like, how are they going to top this next year? And then they do.
And then they do.
So.
Yeah, I definitely think that there's a level of maturity in a lot of this stuff now, too.
Yep.
It's like a lot of the things are starting. You could tell when they did the first Blackmagic Cinema camera and the Pocket camera, and now it's like, at this point, you're really seeing like a mature style of how they're putting everything together. They know where all the problems are. They know what the issues are. They're listening to people. I mean, it's great. It's great. It's very. I think it's pretty rare to have a lot of companies do that too.
Yeah.
I mean, that honestly, really are listening.
What
to
do you
people.
Think about? I mean, maybe this is late in the podcast getting into this, but what do you think about? I mean, we mentioned the idea of Baselight isn't having a booth this year. Companies having booths or not booths.
Talking about refiguring out the formula.
Yeah.
Is exactly what that is. The NAB formula for companies presenting.
I feel like you can kind of see that taking shape in the show floor a little bit.
Yeah.
But I mean, how do you think that speaks to the company itself? Like, do we feel like there's less of a presence of film? Like, seeing them at the Codex booth, it kind of made sense having that there. It fit into what Codex was offering, but it's a market sort of outside of what would normally be looking at a film light. I mean, there's a little bit of a, you know, if we're in the South Hall and a lot of the post stuff is here, and you go into the Central Hall and there's like production stuff, it's a little bit of a different demographic, and it's kind of, it's a different group of nerds.
Exactly.
And so it's like the jockey nerds are over there, and we got the techie nerds over here. And they're cool guys and everything, but it's a different vibe, and I think a different audience for those things.
Yeah.
So I think it's an interesting strategy. I mean, Nakota's sort of doing similar stuff here. They're showing the Nakota, the Digital Vision, showing Nakota at the Renaissance in the suite, which is probably the right way to show a grading application, because I sat on a Mystica demo with a Dolby monitor, and it was not a great environment to be looking at that demo.
Yeah, I think when you're dealing with something as sophisticated as some of these really large scale finishing tools, you know, just the concentration required to keep up with a demo is great, much less run the product. You know, and there are companies that are looking at these items.
And you're doing something, you know, you're trying to see the kind of the finesse and the fine work that's being done in a grading suite, and yet you're looking at it with horrible, you know, CCFL lights that are just like terrible fluorescence, and they're blaring everywhere, and everything's kind of green and gross, and it's, you know, it's impossible to see an image critically in this environment.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's, you know, maybe a challenge of the way that products are presented now is this idea is, you know, there's a lot of money spent at NAB. There are a lot of parts of our industry that are just fine with this method of presentation, but there's a possibility with an intricate tool that this sort of chaotic environment is it's difficult to convey the message and the nuances that these people, you know, will pivot on in their work, you know, being able to find those things in the products in the middle of being pushed around for a spot in front of a guy who's hoarse after day three, you know, trying to tell, you know, the same, you know, 10-minute blurb, you know, for the 100th time.
Right.
I'll say that the flip side of that is that the absence is also noted. You know what I mean? It does create an impression. You need to be in the mind space of your consumer, whether you're presenting your best face forward or not.
Right.
But you know, to stay in their mindset, it's better to it's dangerous to be forgotten. You know, or to be absent.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's the right strategy? It's a little difficult to say. I think.
Yeah.
You know, Apple's not here, but yet their product is everywhere.
Yeah.
And so it's always in the mind space, even if they're physically not in the show floor. On that note, I think we can wrap it up, I guess. But
But it's been this is only Monday.
Yes.
But it's been an action packed NAB so far. It's been really good.
It's been great. It's great as always to get to do this in person, and hopefully we'll be able to do it next year. And you know, I'll wrap up and say that, you know, I'm Juan Salvo. You can find me at juansalvo.com or the Color Space, CLOUR space.com, and on Twitter and everywhere else. And it's great seeing you guys in person.
And I'm Josh Petock. You can see me on Twitter at Josh Petock and various other places like Lift Gamma Gain.
And I'm Jason Myers. You can catch me on Lift Gamma Gain, jasonmyers.com, and also on Twitter at Jason Myers. So with that, thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.